Hello, listeners of the Partial Historians, you sick puppies, you. No, I'm just kidding. You're
all
very
kittens,
welcome.
Kittens, in kittens, please,
yes. Yeah. You're very, very welcome. I am one Dr. Radness, and this lady to my right is Dr. Greenfield.
That welcome. Is me.
Welcome.
Hello. Hello.
Now, we are going to take a slight break from Coriolanus. I know you're all on tenterhooks wondering how his trial is going to come out. Will he get off? Will he not?
Will he stay a patrician? Will he change and become a plebeian?
Ooh, wouldn't that be the ultimate? This is how it's going to end up. I'll give you a hint. They've got a needle filled with plebeian blood. They're going to stab him and it'll all be over.
You wake up in the morning and be like, I agree with the tribune.
That's right. Be like Spider-Man or something. Before we get back to that, because that's very exciting, I wanted to take a quick break and talk to Dr. G, because she has actually visited the motherland, the fatherland,
source of all of our ancient knowledge.
Exactly. She actually has spent the last month or so in Italy. And so we thought we'd do a special bonus Partial Historian episode to talk to Dr. G about some of the things that she got to see while she was away.
Yeah, it's a bit like Instagram Throwback Thursday.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Well, those of you who have been on our Facebook page will know that Dr. G has been very kind enough to share some of her holiday snaps.
I have been trooping around, yes.
Yeah, so tell us, where did you start off in terms of location for your travels?
I began my journey in Rome.
Oh, perfect. I'm loving it already.
You know, why go anywhere else?
Exactly,
really?
Yes.
So I was very fortunate. I spent probably about 3 out of the 4 weeks that I was in Italy in Rome itself.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
Yeah. Exciting times. You know, you do all of the things. So I last went there in 2008, but this time I had much more time to, like, sort of wander around and see things.
Yeah.
The Colosseum.
Nice.
You know.
And the classics.
Oh, the classics.
So what was perhaps the most meaningful thing to you that you saw while you were there?
I think for me, it is always, and nothing has yet trumped this, is the Areopagus.
Yes. See, now, both times I've been in Italy, I'm pretty sure that was closed.
Oh, no.
So I've never actually seen it in real life.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So please, tell us what the Areopagus actually is.
Okay, so the Areopagus, to give it its full name, the Areopagus Augustae, is this structure that has been constructed late in Augustus's career, which is right in my zone of, like, interest.
Augustus being kind of the first emperor. Let's say the first real princeps, who ushers in this system of the princeps after the death of Julius Caesar, and he sort of is in charge at the end of the 1st century BC and into the 1st century AD.
He's like the first / most famous / most infamous figure after Julius Caesar.
He's the Mac Daddy of princeps.
You know, if anybody makes the Roman Empire happen,
it's
this guy's career.
That is true.
Because we tend to date the start of the Roman Empire somewhere after the death of Caesar and somewhere in the start of the career of Tiberius. And the person who straddles those two periods is Augustus.
Yeah, and he is in charge for a long time. And one of his boasts, apparently, was that he found Rome a city of brick and left it a city dressed in marble.
Oh, and fancy pants it is, too.
Yeah.
And I think the Areopagus actually represents the stylistic epoch, if you like, that comes with the sort of the height of his power as well. So this altar of peace is awarded to him by the Senate.
That's what the Areopagus means.
Yes.
BT dubs.
Just doing a bit of a Latin translation there.
I wish.
Although I can't call it the Areopagus if I'm in Italy because they pronounce things differently.
Oh,
and,
of course.
It's the Areopagus. Which is also quite nice. But a side note.
Yeah.
But the Areopagus is granted to Augustus by the Senate for his commitment to peace.
Yes. Well, I mean, of course, before Augustus, you know, when you've got Caesar and Pompey and Crassus and all those sorts of people, and even obviously into Augustus's own sort of period of influence with, you know, the civil wars against Brutus and Cassius and then Antony, there's been a lot of war. It always seems to be the thing with Rome until you get to this period where Augustus can boast that the doors to the temple
The gates of Janus.
Yeah, have been closed. What is it? Three times? Yeah, three times during his rule, because there have been periods of extended peace.
Yeah, yeah. Hilariously. But in order to close those gates three times, obviously you have to reopen them when
a war
happens.
That's true.
So,
you know what they say, when one door closes,
another war opens.
Yeah. Sorry, continue. Yeah.
All right. No, thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, at least we amuse ourselves, if not you, listeners. I apologize in advance. So he has this claim of having closed the gates of Janus three times, which ironically means a lot of warfare has happened and then stopped again.
But at least there have been...
But it has stopped.
There has been...
It has stopped. Yeah. And that is the important thing that's being commemorated with this sort of structure. And so it's offered by the Senate in around about 13 BCE.
Yeah.
After Augustus returns from Gaul. So, you know, he's gotten into a bit of a fight. Comes back.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, peace. Finally, there is peace. And grand amounts of it as well.
Yeah.
Let us build an altar. And it takes them some time to put it together. The whole thing is constructed from marble.
Yes.
And I do recommend, if you have the opportunity at all, and you happen to be in Rome, just go there.
Yeah.
It is a beautifully preserved structure in its current position.
Yeah.
It has a long history of the excavation and the reconstruction, and there's a bit of Mussolini involved in there. I know.
There's fascists.
Yeah.
Co-opting Roman history.
Look, yeah, there's a lot of things going on with that structure itself and the history of its reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that it is currently set up in terms of the museum that has been built around it, to keep it in humidity and temperature control, it's absolutely a delight to see.
Yeah.
And
so what would you be seeing if you go and see?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. So, if you go into this museum of the Areopagus, what you will find is that you've got like a relatively square-like structure, which has some steps going from the south to the north, leading in to what is the center chamber where there's an altar itself.
Right.
So this outside construction, we don't know whether it had a roof or not. Probably, maybe.
Yeah.
We're not sure. But the walls itself on the exterior are highly decorated.
Yes.
And the top panels around the outside have these very intricate friezes.
Mm.
And what you find from looking at it from the front, where you've got the steps leading in, is a couple of friezes where we don't have many of the pieces.
Yes.
And these friezes and the parallel friezes on the back side depict what appear to be highly symbolic, quite sort of divine mythological sort of ideas and scenes.
Right.
And what we get on the sides up the top are continuous friezes that run along the whole length on either side, which is a procession.
Yes.
And we think this is a recognition of the procession that would have taken place, or at least a depiction of the type of procession that would have happened with the dedication itself and the opening of this altar to the people.
Yeah. And there are some representations on part of this is Augustus's family itself, isn't it?
Yeah. A lot of the figures on one side are family members.
Yeah.
And we can identify them. And on the other side, there seems to be a lot of functionaries.
Right.
Which are some random senators.
People whose name have been forgotten by history.
Yes. You know, the Senate can dedicate an altar all they like, and they can even put their face on it, but whether anybody thinks they're worth remembering is another thing entirely. So we got a lot of faces on one side where we're like, oh yeah, there's some people. There's definitely some people in that procession.
They look important.
Definitely some senators, definitely some priests. And one side which is like very clearly, distinctly, including family members of Augustus's broader kinship circle.
Yeah, because when we say family, obviously we mean familia in the in the Roman sense of things.
All the relatives
are
involved.
All the relatives, yeah.
You've got a lot of historical bits and pieces that you can pick up by looking at it.
Yes.
And then you've also got some beautiful sort of mythological scenes, which scholars continue to argue about.
What they're actually representing.
Yeah. So one of the most famous friezes on the back of this building is the one that is thought to be either Tellus, Ceres, Pax, Roma. They can't really quite pinpoint who this woman is.
That's quite a range of characters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And we talk about the polysemy, the multi-meanings, multiple meanings that can be read into this particular image. So you've got this woman who is sort of sitting there and she's holding a child and she's surrounded by other figures, but there's all sorts of vegetation, which is really distinct, and there's all sorts of animal life, which is very distinct as well. And the multitude of symbolism there is just too much for anybody. Everyone's like, oh my goodness, it could be this person. And somebody's like, yes, but it could be this person.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the time you spent some time looking at it, you think, well, it could be anybody, couldn't it?
Yeah. I guess the main thing is, it seems to be religious in nature.
Yeah. I noticed that it seems to be mythological. So I sense I've got a god here of some kind.
Yeah.
It's not a realistic scene.
Yeah.
So we've got that to go with.
Yeah.
But aside from that, any guess is up for grabs, really.
It's kind of amazing that it's survived, I suppose, as well. I mean, being Marvel, sometimes these things are sort of stolen and reused by random Christians.
yeah, it's interesting. They've been finding pieces of this structure since about the 16th century.
Yeah, yeah.
And they eventually cobbled them all together.
Right, okay, so they were kind of disemboweled, I suppose.
Oh yeah, it was broken up into little pieces.
Okay, that makes
sense.
Yeah.
And there's lots of dispute over whether Mussolini's reconstruction, which is what we have today, is
accurate.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
As well.
How interesting. So tell me, what other fantastic sights did you see while you were in Rome? Anything else stand out to you?
Look, I'm a sucker always for the Roman Forum.
Yep.
You know.
Classic.
You know.
Well, I mean, it's a good thing to appreciate now. It might not be standing.
Oh, yeah, look, everything is disintegrating. It is pretty horrific.
Yeah.
The state of preservation and the incapacity of the powers that be invest in that preservation.
If I may be so bold, could I ask what your opinion is on this whole situation? I mean, do you think that they should be allowed, I mean, that they're ruins, that they weren't built to last forever, maybe they should be allowed to just sort of slowly deteriorate? Or do you think that there should be, yeah, I mean, and let's face it, it would cost a lot of money pumped into this sort of a site to keep it as it currently is for future generations to enjoy?
I think it is a very contentious topic.
It is,
because on the one hand, if you're a Roman today, living in Rome, those ruins are often considered an inconvenience to getting anywhere and doing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
The city is only partially functional.
Yes.
As a result of having all of these things that you can't do anything with.
Well, you always hear the classic stories about anyone doing any sort of building work in Rome is always like, dig, 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 damn it, a ruin!
Quick, somebody, yes, you can't actually do any excavations for any new building sites without having an archaeologist on the team, because you will find things.
Yeah.
It is inevitable that stuff will be found,
and then it must be cataloged. You have the privilege of living in Rome,
The privilege of living in Rome.
Yeah.
And when I was talking to people who live there, most of them feel like the ruins, one, contribute so much in terms of their understanding of self.
Yes.
But also the tourism that brings in.
Yeah, I was going to say, the money. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There is a real need, if you like, to keep that tourism industry operational.
Sure,
so investing in the preservation of what remains is not the worst idea anybody's ever had.
No, definitely.
But how do you navigate that with the concerns of the day-to-day lives of Roman citizens in that city now? I think it's really hard.
Mm.
And one of the things that I found that people complained about as well was that certain sites used to be open to citizens for free because you were Roman.
Yes.
And if you lived in the city, it was part of your city and it was part of your privilege as a citizen to just be able to go there and hang out if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And now a lot of those sites, such as the Roman Forum, everybody now must pay a ticket for entry. And you can see how resentment would start to build up, being like, I live in a city and I can't even access the amenities that this city offers.
It's a tricky one, because I suppose not having that kind of situation myself, like, you know, obviously you grow up in a place like Sydney, I don't think there's ever been a place where I've gone to and they said, "Ah, oh, you were born here? Please come in. Don't pay the entry fee.
No fee for you."
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not like, I don't think that's ever happened. And therefore it's just not an expectation of mine. But yeah, I can understand, I suppose, if you've grown up with that sort of expectation, then...
Well,
yeah.
It's almost like they're public parks in many respects. Like the Palatine, the Forum, they're open spaces.
That's true.
And
yeah.
it used to be the case that there was just no gate.
Yeah, okay.
And now there's a gate.
Yeah. Ooh, it's a tricky issue.
It definitely is a tricky issue, yeah.
Mm. So were you... Because I know it's been a few years since you were in Rome. Were you shocked? Like, could you notice a difference in what was there, or was it more just, you know, you've heard about the collapses and that sort of thing, and therefore you were sort of on the lookout for them?
No, not really. I mean, I took a very sort of, I was trying not to be too much of a historian, to be honest. What I did notice was that, you know, new places in the Forum are now under excavation that weren't under excavation before.
Okay. Yeah,
and the places that I couldn't get into in the Forum, I now had access to. I took a lot of photos of the areas that are associated with the atrium of the Vestals, so the house of the Vestals.
Yes, the Vestal version.
Because last time I was there, I couldn't get into that section. There was actual archaeological work taking place, and it was all blocked off. And now it's open. I was like, oh yes.
So what did you think?
Oh, you know, it was very exciting. I took pictures of all the statues.
Yeah,
it was just a pleasure to be able to be. To be humbled by the experience of being so close, to the things that I've spent so long theoretically and abstractly studying, and to know that I'm standing on the space, in the location where the things that I'm really interested and curious about ancient Rome were happening.
Yeah, I think that's just it. I think being historians of that part of the world, from Australia, as you and I are. It often does start to feel like a bit of a wonderful story. And you don't mind because you enjoy the story. But then when you actually go there, you're like, holy shit, this stuff is real.
The stories were true. Yeah, true. What are you saying?
It just sort of blows
me?
Your mind to suddenly realize I'm actually in the place. You know? Like, I felt the same way when I went to, you know, Capri and stood up on the peak at the...
Thought about all of the boys.
No, I did not. But yeah, like standing up on the, you know, on the ruins of the Villa Jovis, like Tiberius's and others, sort of royal retreat, I suppose, imperial retreat. And yeah, it was kind of weird to think, like, this is a view that he would have seen. Like, no matter how much else this has changed, this probably is something that we both share. And it's just such a bizarre connection to have after thousands of years.
Yeah. For sure. And I think it makes you realize that your commitment as a historian is really to find something of the truth of the narrative if you can.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's incredibly difficult given what remains.
It just makes it that little bit more concrete though, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you're like, you know, I have on some level a duty to the people who live these lives to try my best to get it right for them.
Yeah.
You know, and that is compelling as well, I think.
Yeah. So tell me, when you went a bit further afield, did you bump into any sites of historical significance?
Oh, look, I tried to bump into as many historical sites as I possibly could. I did attempt quite strenuously to see the Temple of Diana, which is on Lake Nemi, which is not very far from Rome at all.
Yeah.
You can do it as a day trip, not a problem. And actually, they'd had an incredible festival there a few months previously.
In the temple?
Well, around the ruins and the structure of it, celebrating it, because it's a famous spot in the area.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the sort of the lake region just to the south of Rome.
Sure.
And it's important as a structure from my perspective because it sits along the Appian Way.
Right.
In its oldest form. Not that you can really follow it that clearly today.
Yeah.
But I was curious to see it even though I'm pretty sure it's just a pile of stone.
Yeah.
But we couldn't get in.
when would this have been erected initially?
That is an excellent question, and you know, I can't even remember.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, with, like, you know, imperial or... Yeah.
I'm not... Yeah, like, the details elude me right
That's
now.
That's okay, yeah.
But, yeah, I was on this quest a failed quest, as it turned out. We ended up driving down a very, very rocky road that you'd only go one way on, winding down the side of a hill, only to find ourselves at the location. And the man there who was brushing his horse was like, oh, it's definitely closed, man. It's going to be closed for months.
Run away.
Ah, get out, back up the hill.
Seems like a bizarre thing to close if it is just like a pile of rubble, but...
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, they had a festival there, so maybe they were trying to let everything, like, the sort of grass recover or whatever. Yeah,
fair enough.
I don't know. What I did see, which was exceptionally exciting from my perspective, was a frieze of the Vessel Virgins, which is kept in a museum in Palermo.
Ah, is this the one that you posted about on the Facebook page?
Yes, I believe so. Okay, yes, because cool. I was very excited.
Yeah.
And... I was almost not able to see it as well.
Yeah.
Hilariously. You know how these things go.
Yeah, yeah.
In any case, so I'd gone down to Sicily, like a good historian would, to track down the artifact I needed to see.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to see it in person. The pictures that exist of it are all right, but I wanted to have my own.
Yeah.
And also to be able to, like, go back to it and try to do some more detailed looking at it to try and figure out what might be happening.
Yeah.
They seem to be in some sort of religious moment. It's some sort of processional thing, but there's also a seated figure.
Right.
And I was like, it's all very curious. So I contacted the museum, the Museo Archeologico Antonio Salinas in Sicily before I'd left. And I was like, I'm really interested in seeing this artifact. What do you think, guys? I'm a scholar. And they replied back to me very kindly. And they're like, yeah, we don't know. You know, our museum's under reconstruction at the moment. You know, it's got renovations going on. And we don't know what will be open and closed by the time you get here. And I was like, fair enough. And I was like, oh, well, take a risk.
Yeah.
After some persuasion and a very kindly museum staff member who had been there for like over 20 years, we were given a private tour of the section of the museum that was closed to the public.
That is pretty special.
Yeah, yeah.
Was that because you pulled out your doctor card?
It was because I had a very good Italian guide with
me.
Nice.
Who
could speak the intricate language of negotiation, which is a little bit beyond me at this point. I can smile and, you know, blink with my eyelashes quite convincingly. But apart from that, I don't know if I pass as a doctor because I don't have the right sort of, like, you know, stature or hair color. But in any case, they very kindly invited us into the section of the museum that was closed for renovations.
Yeah.
And not only did I get to see the frieze I was really interested in and to take as many photos as I desired, but he also ended up giving us a private tour of the whole Etruscan collection that they have, which is apparently the largest outside of the mainland.
Yeah.
And there were some incredible pieces there as well. So,
because, yeah, I mean, listeners may recall, if they've been with us from the beginning of our journey, that, you know, the Etruscans are a rather shady bunch of characters because although we know they were, you know, a significant presence in Italy and on the Romans, like on Roman culture, there's very little written evidence left from these people. So most of what we have are in fact artifacts of some description.
Yeah. And some of them are incredibly detailed. So so I got to see some sarcophagi that were very intricately carved and like with the very traditional Etruscan statue as part of the lid with the reclining and things like that. Yeah.
Eternal slumber.
Oh, yes. So I have to say it was, for me, obviously, like, as a historian, there's certain things that, like, I will nerdly get excited about.
Yeah.
And nobody else understands why I might be excited, which is fine. But yeah, I think for anybody who's got an interest in history, obviously having a chance to see the cultures that you're really inspired by in front of you is a real privilege.
Yeah, and I suppose the thing about somewhere like Italy is, again, something that's sort of hard for us to appreciate sometimes in Australia just because of the nature of our history, peculiar as it is, that there's just so much for them to take care of, you know, that in some ways, although I do not condone entirely the way that they handle management of important sites and that sort of thing, at the same time, there's just so much, you know. It requires so much care and attention and money and that sort of thing that I think our minds would boggle if we really sort of put it into perspective like that. So yeah, being able to sort of chew around and see all those sorts of things, I can imagine.
Yeah.
It's very enlightening.
Yes, it was.
Mm. Any other experiences you'd like to share with us, Dr. D, before we depart? Or?
Look, I think that pretty much sums up all of the major highlights for me.
Nice.
I mean, I did spend a lot of time doing nothing.
Yeah,
yeah.
It was a holiday. It wasn't like this was like a partial historian's jaunt.
Only.
Yeah, sorry.
A partially funded.
Oh, wow. That's what we could do. All right. Well, thank you very much for sharing some of your holiday experiences with us, Dr. G.
A pleasure.
And I hope that the listeners enjoyed hearing about some of the highlights of your journey.
Oh, me too.